Hi, this is Bob Bretall, and welcome to the June Previews interview episode. We've got an all-top cow episode this month. We've got
Hello, two interviews, the first with David Hine and Jeff Wamister,
who are talking about the four-issue Darkness four
In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects.
And then we're going to talk to Phil Smith, who's the writer on the Witchblade Due Process one-shot that has art by Alina Urasov. A couple of great books, both in the Top Cow section of your previous catalog, and we're going to start with talking with David and Jeff. I've got with me here today David Hine and Jeff Wamister, who are the writer and artist, respectively, on the book The Darkness, Four Horsemen, which is a four-issue miniseries in the June previews. You'll find it on page 203 of the previews catalog. Thanks for being with me, David and Jeff.
You're welcome.
Hello.
So why don't you guys start with telling me about how the series came to be and a little bit of the high concept for it.
I should start on that because I've been on this project for longer than Jeff. This actually started way back when I was writing Spawn. I was talking to the editor and to Todd about maybe doing a crossover book with Spawn and the Darkness because it seemed like a pretty good match. And the story I came up with revolved around the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, who were occupying the bodies of basically four bikers. I'm not quite sure that crossover never happened, and I just kind of shelved it and forgot about it. But then a little while later, I was talking to I think it was Rob Levin when he was working at Top Cow, and we were talking about doing something on the Darkness. And that idea came up again, and it seemed like it would work without Spawn. So I kind of rejigged the whole story, and we still have the basic concept of these. What happens is, at some time in the past, back in the 60s, in fact, these four bikers get involved in a drug deal that goes wrong, and they disappear into the desert. They come back, 45 years later, and they haven't aged, but they've changed. And they've basically become possessed somehow by the Four Horsemen, war, famine, disease, and pestilence, and death. And we see the effect they have when they hit a town in California and start unleashing. It's almost like it's the apocalypse on a small scale. Because to start with, they're not unleashing full-scale Armageddon, but they have those inherent powers to bring disease, death, whatever, to anyone who comes in contact with them. So we start off with Armageddon on a very small scale, and we actually waited a long time before starting this book because we were looking for the right artist and. When we found Jeff, that was basically it. We contacted him, asked him if he could do the book, and you know, since then we've been firing all cylinders. Now, I was really pleased that we found Jeff. Fantastic artwork.
So Jeff, I've seen your work on Frenemy of the State from Oni, and you did that story in the MySpace Dark Horse Presents. I think it was number 8. Online that's in the second trade that they published, and really nice style. I like, you got a really clean line, so I'm looking forward to seeing your work on this series. Tell me a little bit about how you approach this, you know, working with David, and also, you know, how much design work you got to do on the look of the Four Horsemen and anything else about it.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a another artist did a little bit of work on it. I can't say for sure, but looking at, had done a couple of designs for a couple of the characters and, not the other two. So I kind of jumped in and did two of the characters, after the fact. And then, we kind of just, jumped right in and started doing some art. So, some of it was designing on the fly. Some of it was, you know, taking some of that previous stuff and getting right into it. So, it was fun because I got to take my own twist on it a little bit and kind of add to it too.
So which are the ones you got to design?
Death and War, I believe it was.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
Cool. So, David, are you working full script on this? Or are you, trying to give plot points? How is the collaboration working between the
two? I'm afraid I'm a full scripter. I'm a little bit of a dictator in that way. having said that, anything that Jeff comes up with, which is better than what I suggest, I always go along with. I think so anyway. But I've got this thing where I always do thumbnails of my scripts, basically to make sure that the storytelling is working. And while I don't actually give those thumbnails to the artist, I'll lay out a page and then describe the way I've laid it out. So you're getting something a little more detailed than a screenplay would be, for instance. I do suggest camera angles and close-ups and that kind of thing. I don't know whether Jeff's found that problematic.
not at all. I actually have been enjoying the whole process of working with these guys. My editors have been great, and the writer, Dave, you've been great. So I've really kind of really enjoyed myself because it had let me have just enough creativity to go in there, but not so much where I feel like I don't know if I know exactly where the plot's going. So I've felt like the whole time that it's been – right in my comfort zone for working in this stuff. So it's been a blast.
That's good. Yeah, I have to say, once I know who I'm working with, I tend to loosen up a little bit. But, of course, this story was virtually three-quarters written before Jeff came on board. So, I was really writing blind. I didn't know who was going to be drawing it. So I do tend to, once I know how an artist works, my scripts do get a little bit looser.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, if you don't know who you're going to be working with, you kind of want to bulletproof the script by really putting the description in that you want to see on the page. So
yeah,
that's completely understandable. So are you done with the story now, David?
I still have the last the fourth part to write. So I'm going to have to get going on that pretty soon. Jeff's, you're into part two.
Correct.
So, I've got a little while. I've got a bit of leeway yet. But you should be getting the last script fairly soon.
So here's an interesting question I like, on artists, because a lot of artists work differently. So Jeff, when you're putting this together, talk a little bit about your process and, you're doing both the pencils and the inks on this. I mean, are you doing this traditional? What kind of digital process are you using? And also, how long does it take you to do a page, going from layouts through your final inks?
Well, the thing about it is with the editing process, you kind of have to move ahead a little bit. There isn't like you make a thumbnail in the morning and then send it up to your editors, hit approval and stuff like that all in one day. It's more of like you try to do three or four thumbnails ahead of time, send that off to your editors while you're finishing, penciling one page and then inking the next, which makes it kind of interesting, but at the same time, we have to try to be as efficient as we can through that process. The process basically is I first throw a thumbnail. It's usually about 2 by 3 inches. Really, really rough. Hopefully, the editors can see what I'm doing, but I'm not so much where I'm, trying to be too tight. Just trying to get where they're placed in each frame, or in each panel. And then what I do is I'll scan that in, send that off to these guys, Steve and my editors at Top Cow. And, they'll come back with suggestions or approvals or, try agains, et cetera. And then once I know that, I'll actually, take those scans that are in of the thumbnails, and I'll blow it up to about a 8.5 by 14 or a legal size. Print that out and kind of trace the placements of each character and where the frame is, so that whatever happens, I'm getting the editors and they are getting what they saw in the thumbnail. There's not a big change or something like that, so that they know what to expect each time, and then I go in and pencil those placements in, you know, fairly tight, not too tight, but, you know, enough so they can definitely see what people's expressions are and how they're moving and get a feel for them. And then I send that off to be approved. Once that approved comes back, you know, the next chance I do start doing inking again, I'll go in and ink that, send that off for approval. And that's about it, except sometimes there's a patch here or there, but that's pretty much the gist of it. Nothing exciting, but it works.
I know Phil Hester is writing the main Darkness title. Is he involved in the process at all, just to kind of keep it? I mean, is this, let me ask it this way, is this story, because Jackie Estacado, he gets involved somehow, you know, he hears about the stuff that's going on out in the California desert, and somehow he's getting pulled into this. Is this being made to sync up with the main Darkness title that's running along, or is this kind of like a side story that happens at some indeterminate period of time?
Thankfully, we don't have to tie in with the monthly book, because as I say, I did start writing this a couple of years back, and we deliberately, because a lot of, you know, Jackie Estacado in the monthly title was going through a lot of changes. I mean, Phil was doing some really crazy things with him. This was back, the relaunch, really. It started again from number one, didn't it? And, you know, Jackie was losing control of Darkness, lost the Darkness completely. And we decided that the safest thing would be to set the story like, I think 3 years in the past, which has now become, I guess, 5 years in the past. So I think the story is set around 2005, which means we don't have to worry about whatever's happening in the monthly title. But Phil Hester has read the script, so he knows what's going on with it now. But it's definitely out of continuity, very much a self-contained story.
Okay, great. So people that just have like kind of the basic idea of the Darkness can pick this up. They don't have to worry about whether they're reading the current series or not. It's
sure.
A nice standalone story that somebody can read.
Okay. Yeah,
great.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I always try to do that with my books anyway, because I tend to hop in and out of titles and play with characters that are going through some pretty weird stuff. And I do try very much to make every story I do pretty much self-contained, because I know that's problematic with comic books in general these days. There's so much crossover happening between titles that I think it's a bit alienating for a lot of people who are trying to, you know, who are picking up comics for the first time. I very much believe that you have to take into account that person who's picking up this comic book for the first time. They've never read another book featuring those characters. You know, you have to make it accessible.
I'm very happy you said that. You know, that's something that we talk about on our review show quite a lot. You know, it's like when I pick up a number one issue, if it's a number one, even if it's a mini series, it's got a number one on it, and someone is going to pick it up that has never picked up that one before. So the fact that you kind of go out of your way to explain, I'm assuming what you just said was you kind of went out of your way to explain who Jackie is and what the Darkness is, and, you know, kind of give at least some kind of setup for that new reader, and that's always good.
Well, I wouldn't say, I didn't spend a lot of time on exposition. I think because once you know that Jackie has the power of the Darkness, and that he's involved with the Mafia, essentially. I've given him that role that he originally had, where he's basically a hitman for the Mafia. And in the opening scene, that's pretty much established. I don't go into a whole lot of backstory, because I think that would turn off it, whether you're a new reader or you're already familiar with the story. You don't want to wade through pages and pages and pages of that stuff. So you get thrown straight into the action in the first couple of pages. But I don't think anyone would have any problem. That's a good point to ask Jeff. I mean, he's come into this story pretty fresh, I guess, so he can back me up on that, or otherwise, whether it's completely accessible for us.
I would have to agree. It is. It seems extremely accessible to me, because the way he sets up the story without having to expose about it. I think anybody comes in, they'll know immediately what's going on or have a feel for what the character of the darkness is about, within the first 5 pages, I would say. So it's very quick.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to get at is not that you need to have a lot of exposition about past continuity or anything, but you kind of, through the course of the storytelling, without breaking the story and making it seem like it's a, you know, kind of who's who page, which that's not good. But, you know, you're just establishing, like you said, this is who the character is. He's a hitman for the mafia. This is basically what his powers are, and you're showing through the usage of those powers or something. You know, somebody gets the idea as you're pulling them into the story what's going on. Yeah. And not just like, what the heck is this? And that's important.
It's kind of funny because I hadn't realized until we had gotten through partway through the first one that it wasn't in some way involved in the continuity. So I had a feeling immediately, just from me reading the book and drawing it, that I knew what the darkness was about immediately without even having to necessarily have been following the continuity, if that makes sense.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, I mean, making something be new reader friendly like that, there's a certain craft to that. So I'm glad that that's in the front of your mind when you're putting something like this together, David. I'm glad to hear when you're describing that's something that's on your mind when you come to a project.
Absolutely. I don't know that I always succeed, but I certainly aim for that. Yeah. That's right. This has been a really fun project because, working for Top Cow, there's actually a lot more leeway in what you can get away with. After doing a lot of books for Marvel and DC, which have been great fun, but you're always aware that you're really writing books that have to be appropriate for young teens. And with this book, I've really enjoyed, being able to have characters use profanity, really let rip with the violence, not in a gratuitous way, of course, but I did feel like suddenly the cuffs were off, as it were, and it's really been great fun doing a book that's really a little bit more adult orientated than all the other stuff I've been doing.
Oh, like FVZA. Was very kid-friendly.
we had a little bit of profanity, not for violence there as well.
Yeah. So let me direct over to you, Jeff, really quick about some of your other work. So I read issue number one of Frenemy of the State. I'm gonna hope that you're continue on with that. So are you on that book as well?
Yes. Yeah. It's been a blast too, but they're kind of polar opposites. Two
right.
books.
That's kind of a light. I kind of like the feel in that one, but you know, that was kind of getting back to my question about how long it takes you to do, a page or something. It's like, can you do, are you able to do more? Because some artists, you know, they can barely even do one book a month. But, you know, if you're working on the Darkness Four Horsemen here and you're also doing Frenemy of the State, can you kind of keep up and get more than one book a month out?
Yeah, well, the schedules are a little looser than one a month. They're a little bit more like 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to manage that pretty easily. Save a few, save a broken arm in there, but it's been actually good because the process I've developed through it is fairly quick because of being able to transfer from thumbnails to pencils. I usually cut out a couple hours right there, and I usually cut a couple of hours out of the penciling process because I'm making it myself, so I don't have to be tight.
Right.
So there's a lot of time that gets cut out of it because I'm doing both steps, cutting out a lot of time that it would take in those steps and
right.
allowing me to produce a lot more.
Okay, cool.
I did actually see Jeff's, you sent us a schedule at one stage. I remember seeing where you had like the next month planned out, and you actually had this the most incredibly disciplined thing I've ever seen. Your days for penciling, days for inking, days for laying out pages. I wish I could be that disciplined, really. I was very impressed.
Oh, thanks. It's been ruined a little bit with a broken arm, but, you know.
Yeah, that couldn't have helped. It's not funny. I'm sorry. I didn't laugh.
Don't worry. I'm laughing about it myself because, you know, what are you going to do? There's not much you can do about it. It just happens, you know.
Is it your drawing arm or your other arm?
No, it's my other arm, thankfully. But it makes it extremely difficult to hold a drawing board or a ruler with your hand because it's actually my forearm, the radial bone there. So I can't turn the hand at all. I'm trying to, you know, back or flat, it has to stay in one position. Otherwise, it's pretty painful. I'm in the process of setting up so that I can compensate for that. So,
yeah, he's going to be drawing with his teeth.
Get your little kids to come in and hold the ruler. Hold Dad's ruler now.
I was thinking about getting an intern just to come in and just hold the ruler.
So, David, you're doing some other stuff. You just finished up, relatively recently, that Spider-Man Noir series over at Marvel. You're working you did that Arkham Reborn series. A book that just came out in the last couple of weeks that I really liked that you did also for Image, I believe, that Bulletproof Coffin, number one, with Shaky Kane.
Oh, yeah.
That was brilliant.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked the Bulletproof Coffin. I've got to say, although I'm enjoying a lot of other books, the Bulletproof Coffin is it's the most important project because, first of all, working with Shaky, who I've known since my college days, we've always been good friends, and somehow we never got to work together. And you know, finally getting to work with Shaky is just fantastic because we have a shared vision of popular culture, comics, of everything, really. And also, of course, we own it, you know, which is, it's nice to not have someone looking over your shoulder to know that whatever you do, success or failure, it's down to us and nobody else, you know. And so far, it's been getting a fantastic reception, you know. It's gone down very well. So
his art in that issue is fabulous, and it's like just the detail and some of the, you know, just background, you know, pop culture junk and some of those scenes, and just it's fabulous to look at. I'm really, and the way you kind of wove that kind of like that Golden Nuggets comic into there, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how you're going to do more of that, and even, you know, putting yourself, you know, David Hein and Shaky Kane as the, you know, creators from Golden Nuggets, and the text piece at the back, which I'm assuming you wrote, and, you know, just great. Great work.
Wait till you see the last issue. You're going to see Shaky Kane, Dave Hein at the age of 80, but still toting guns. Shaky just did that cover for the final issue a couple of days ago, and it's just hilarious. It really is. Yeah, that's been a great one. I've also got a couple of monthly books coming up from DC. I'm taking over on Azrael. And on the Spirit as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm loving is
that's Moritasa.
Right. So, art. Yeah, so Justin's still going to be doing the art on it, and you're taking over the writing?
That's right, yeah. And still the drone on covers.
Excellent.
Gabriel Bautista on colors. So it's a great team to work with. I mean, it's basically the all the guys that worked on Elephant Men coming in, working on the Spirit.
And I love Elephant Men, and I've been really eating up Moritat's work on the Spirit issues that have come out so far. So, you know, very good.
Yeah, it's a book he was born to draw, I think.
Okay, well, unless you guys have anything else to say about the Four Horsemen, I will thank you for joining me, and I will take the listeners to task and say, if this sounds interesting, and how can the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse in the body of bikers wreaking havoc being taken to task by the darkness not sound cool, make sure you go to your comic shop now while they are putting their orders together for this book and let them know that you're interested in getting it so that they order enough copies for their shop. It's on page 203 of the June previews catalog. And thank you, Jeff and David, for taking the time with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and now I've got with me Phil Smith, who is writing the Witchblade Due Process one-shot that's in the previews catalog on page 206. Thanks for joining me today, Phil.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks for letting me swim in your pool.
Okay, so the Witchblade Due Process, it's got to do with Sarah kind of making amends for something she did in the past before she got the Witchblade. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the, you know, kind of high concept for the story without doing any spoilers or anything, but, you know, where you came up with the idea and how it kind of fits into what's going on in Witchblade?
Sure. Well, basically the idea behind the story is about what happens to someone when the justice system breaks down. And what I liked about the story was that even without the supernatural elements of Witchblade itself, it's still a story that a lot of people can relate to. Basically, a guy gets sent to prison for a crime he didn't commit. And because he's now sort of outside of what most people's normal experience in society is, he has to fend for himself, and rules kind of get skewed in a strange way. Basically, in society, when you have justice and law and rules and all that sort of thing, there's expectations. If I walk down the street, people hopefully aren't going to shoot at me, and if they do, there's going to be repercussions and all that sort of thing. Well, this is a story about a guy who, when cops frame him for something he didn't commit, he has to survive by whatever means are at his disposal, and it's about those types of hard decisions.
So if he was framed for a crime he didn't commit, now I'm going to assume that Sarah was not one of the people framing him. What was her role in him going to jail that she feels this, you know, kind of guilt over and feeling the need to make amends to this guy?
She was a member of the party that was sent to arrest him. Mm-hmm. Basically, she was a young rookie cop still in uniform. And, you know, I was in the military, and oftentimes we would get orders, and you wouldn't know what you were doing until you got there.
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah was in that type of scenario. In this situation, basically a bunch of crooked cops had done something heinous, were on the verge of getting caught, but they were able to pin it on this guy. And so these cops, who are guilty, literally go to this guy's house in the middle of the night. He's having dinner with his beautiful daughter, beautiful wife. Like a Bon Jovi video, Living on a Prayer, and you're walking. And, you know, everything's perfect. They're struggling, but they're happy. And then the cops break down the door. The guy has no idea why he's being arrested, but the cops have told everyone that this guy has done something terrible. So they really let rip on the guy, clubbing him in front of his family and all that sort of thing. Sarah tries to stop them, but is held back. Now, at this time, she's not a super heroine or anything, but she's still a good person. So she tries to stop it, but she can't. And the guy gets caught up in the wheels of the justice system and what these crooked cops have formulated around this guy. And he ends up going to prison. And I won't spoil the story, but I'll give you the springboard. And what's basically on the surface in the story is in order to survive in prison, he becomes a member of a white supremacist group. Otherwise, he would just get torn up by all the different gangs and whatnot. But the supernatural element comes in that a demon comes to him and offers him a deal, like the classic Faustian deal with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
But like with any deal with the devil, there are catches you don't find out about till later.
Oh, of course.
And, of course. And so the demon seduces him, sort of lures him into joining this white supremacist cult that the demon is sort of fostered and brewed in the prison system, and then things go downhill from there. That's sort of where the story starts. And it's just the story raises the question of when the cops aren't on your side, who do you turn to? In this case, this character turns to a demon who offers to keep his family safe and protected while he's on the inside. But the way that it manifests outwardly is that he becomes a member of what appears to be a white supremacist group. Really, it's under the subtle influence and machinations of this demon. The story starts at his parole hearing. most of what I've relayed gets told through flashback. And Sarah is speaking on his behalf, trying to explain that, you know, when she was a rookie cop, she didn't realize that it was a wrongful arrest. Evidence has come to light in recent years that this guy was innocent. But in the meantime, this guy has become hardened on the inside. But Sarah still feels that she should try to make it right. And so she tries to sort of shepherd him back into normal life. But he's been in prison for about 10 years. And that kind of life takes its toll on somebody. And it raises the question of whether or not once a mistake like that has been made, once an innocent person has been sent to prison, can you fix it? Because of all the things that, all the dominoes that fall afterwards.
Right. Because, I mean, he's not the same person anymore. He might have been, you know, this nice, innocent guy when he was sent to prison in the first place. But now a lot of the choices that he's made have kind of made him not that nice of a guy. However, I can understand because, you know, now Sarah, she feels partially responsible because she helped, you know, she was complicit in putting him in there. I mean, she wasn't the driving force, but, you know. And now that put him on this road where he probably wouldn't have been this kind of bad guy otherwise. So, yeah, that's very interesting.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about the creative process with your artist, Alina Urasov, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce her last name, but yeah, I think you're as close as I'm going to get.
Yeah, she's done some really nice work. She's done a lot of covers. She's done a couple of full issues for Marvel, but, you know, mostly she's done a lot of cover work, really nice covers. So what was your process for working with her? And I assume you've seen some of the art so far. You know, how's the panel-to-panel continuity looking?
We're actually still very early in the development phase of it all. The way that the project came about is that there was an opening in our preview section for a Witchblade book, and we needed to slot something in very quickly. And I had this idea roiling around for a while. Well, there were a couple of different stories we pitched, but the Witchblade one is what stuck. So we rolled right into previews with Alina doing the cover just in time. And we're actually doing a little bit of catch-up in order to make the schedule. But having worked with Alina on the cover, she's very fast, very professional. And we're shooting to have the book finished in mid-July with a 2 or 3 week turnaround for delivery the first week of August. So we're actually flying by the seat of our pants on it at the moment. The first set of layouts are actually not coming until this Sunday.
Okay, so are you have you got the script done at this point? Are you working full script with her?
Yeah, we went full script partly because we wanted to loop in Ron Mars, who's the Top Cow architect and has written more issues of Witchblade, I believe, than any other writer up to this point.
Right.
Anything Witchblade, I don't want to. The expression I used to use in the Navy was pee in his Cheerios.
Yeah.
So we definitely looped Ron in on Witchblade stuff. And so also I'm not a very good speaker or pitch man. I describe to someone an idea, but it doesn't really gel until they kind of see how it all plays out. I've heard the stories of other creators that have this great idea, but it doesn't make sense when you explain it until it's fleshed out. So we did the full script, and then once they saw that, oh yeah, this guy's whole story can be told in a compact way, and it all fits into a one-shot, and that's part of the reason we went full script. And also working with Alina for the first time, we wanted to test it out this way and see what her process is like, and so far it's been great.
Oh, very good. So you did the script, you shot that over to Ron gave you notes or whatever, kind of blessed it, you know, you maybe made some changes to it, and then shot that over to Alina, and now she's working it at this point.
She's working on it. Also, Philip Sadlick. Basically, the normal editorial process that we go through is the really big, big, big broad stroke stuff. Matt Hawkins has approval on. Then once we get our marching orders from Matt, Philip and I make it work. Oh, that's another confusing thing about how we do things at Top Cow right now. There's three three guys named Phil who work at Top Cow. There's Philip Sablich, there's me, Phil Smith, and then there's Phil Hester, the writer of The Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we're working together, we just go by last names. But whenever a story comes through Top Cow, Philip and I both read it. If it's script notes to a writer, I give my notes to Philip. He consolidates, bounces it to the writer. If it's art notes, Philip gives me his art notes. I roll mine in, and I send it to the artist, and that's kind of how we flip-flop the editorial duties. But in this case, we looped Ron in as the second pair of eyes, and mm-hmm. also because he is Witchblade. So that's kind of how that went through. Basically, I pitched a bunch of ideas to Matt and Phillip. We got down to the Witchblade idea. Once it was Witchblade, looped Ron in and took it away from there. Ron had some great input and great feedback. I'm pretty green at writing. I've read a fair amount of scripts up to this point, having worked my way up from being an intern for the last 8 years here at Top Cow.
Well, you did Trinity Blood on the Sands book about a year ago.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
So that was your first, published comic?
Yeah, that was the first published comic that made it to market. I actually got into comics through a friend. I had self-published three issues of a comic that didn't make it to market for reasons that are much clearer to me now, having worked in the business a little while. It was basically a grand sci-fi epic, and I made a lot of mistakes that newbie writers often make, which is try to make things overly poetic or too many words, and just stuff that wasn't necessary, that was pretty to look at but didn't really make sense. Also, the story was about the space Nazis who come to attack an Earth full of hermaphrodites. It was not a high concept that lent itself well to the bookshelf, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
But it was fun. But it ended up getting me an internship. I had self-published it with J.K. Woodward, who has done a lot of work for IDW on Fallen Angel and a Marvel origin story for the Beast in their Painted line of books. And so Jim broke into business with it, and I broke in on the editorial side with that story. And here we are 8 years later.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. Well, you got your foot in the door now. The Blood on the Sands was an interesting book. For anyone who missed it, came out a year ago. You probably can still find it, but that one had dark. It was set in the 13th century, mm-hmm. and it had the artifacts, you know, from the Darkness, the Witchblade, and Angelus, right, and different mm-hmm. characters using those, kind of in a historical context. So that one didn't really need to fit that closely into current continuity, but it was kind of a fun twist on how those things all work together.
Yeah, even so, on that one, we had a lot of input from Ron, because at the time, we had the War of the Witchblades storyline happening in Witchblade, and in the story that I was telling, it was the Witchblade story in that book was a cautionary tale on what could have happened to the modern-day heroes if basically they hadn't been so heroic and self-sacrificing. Mm-hmm. It was the opposite side of the coin. And a few readers got it, and I got some nice feedback and reviews on that story, especially that story, because it had, I think kind of because it had a dark ending,
mm-hmm.
It resonated with a lot of people, and it allowed me to create a darkness villain that really took no prisoners. An appeal for a lot of writers to when they come to work on something at Top Cow is they kind of like to play with some of the earlier versions of our modern characters, which mm-hmm. is something that the Top Cow universe can support. Basically, you can take the Witchblade and say, "Oh, I want to tell a story of a Nordic Witchblade bearer who lived in ancient Finland in the 9th century." They can do that. Or if they have a Viking story they want to tell, but just need to tweak it a little bit, that can be a darkness story, like we had with Phil Hester did a darkness story that was done in that way called Lodbrok's Hand. And it was basically a Viking version of the darkness, and it was great. Art by Michael Avon Oeming, and it was really nice to look at, too.
You bring up an interesting point, though, because, I mean, these artifacts have been around for a long, long, long time, but there's only one holder of them at any given time, right? So is there some Bible laying around somewhere that's got, well, here's where we've used them for these time periods through history, and this is where they are, so you can kind of look and see where there's an open slot that you can, you know.
Having worked at TopCal for as long as I have, I've seen different iterations of a project like what you're describing come up and come down. Basically, there is not a template, nothing like that. Everything at TopCal is very organic as regards how the universe is structured, which is great for writers like Ron and Phil Hester, because while we have loose guidelines, they have the latitude and the trust in us to just say, you know, you guys have established that the Wishblade is this, this, and this. I want to tell a story where this takes place, but that would mean sacrificing this, because we're not married to continuity and don't have a Bible like what you described. They can feel free to do that. There are some things that we do keep intact specifically regarding the characters, and we're hesitant to let go of those things. But if a writer comes to us with a compelling reason and story, and the story is good, they can basically take our rules and blow them out of the water. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've heard that, you know, that's Joe Quesada, you know, has the same exact opinion about continuity.
Sure. Well, we don't like to do that thing, I think the expression is retconning, where you basically kind of drive past a continuity point without looking at it in the rearview mirror. We do try to acknowledge what's taken place, but at the same time, there are new things taking place in the TopCal universe, artifacts especially, which everything Ron's written up to this point is kind of pointing to it, and there's been seeds planted in different books. There's going to definitely be some surprise appearances over the course of the 13 issues, and we're really hoping that the fans will take the opportunity to jump on board with this project, because it really is going to set the stage for what we do for quite some time, mm-hmm. and pay off to a lot of long time. There's a ton of Easter eggs. I mean, even in the first couple pages, there's a lot of payoffs for hardcore fans. Old characters who have been on the shelf for a while are back in full swing and at their full potential under Ron's guidance, of course. And it's going to be a lot of fun for sure.
Well, I mean, since he's been writing so many of those things for so long, I mean, he's been writing Witchblade for at least probably more than 5 years at this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think when Witchblade issue 80 came out.
He started at 80.
Name it off. Yeah.
It came out in 2004, so, you know, like 6 years, you know, he's been driving that. And now, I mean, if I look at, you know, the stuff that you guys put out, well, I mean, Phil Hester's doing The Darkness, but Witchblade and Magdalena and Artifacts and Velocity, that's, you know, the rest of your lineup outside of The Darkness. Ron's writing all that stuff, so, you know, he can kind of keep that stuff consistent in and of itself.
That's the big advantage to having Ron behind the wheel on all those titles, is that he's kind of keeping the continuity straight in his head. And he knows that if he plants a seed in his issue of Angelus, let's say 4 or 5, he can pick up and explore that seed the way he originally pictured it. Like, there are sometimes when writers, they write something and they hope to come back to it. But what sometimes happens is another writer will pick it up or touch on it in a completely different title. I think that might happen more at Marvel and DC more than here. Mm-hmm. But with Ron literally having his finger on the pulse of everything and also being close friends with Phil Hester, he can really develop these threads and bring them out the way they were meant to be from the get-go, which is a great advantage. So. But yeah, Artifacts is going to drop a big bomb, and hopefully fans will really enjoy it. We've already got the splash image out to retailers that features art by all the Pit artists and our regular and ongoing series artists, Kenneth Rocafort, Stephen Sage, Sheldon Mitchell, Nelson Blake, and Mark and Michael Bussard.
Very good. So any more writing in the future for you? I assume you're going to keep on pitching story ideas.
Yeah, every there's one story I've been pitching for the last 4 or 5 years, and every couple of years I get a bite on it, and they go, oh, wow, that'd be really interesting to do. And then it, for one reason or another, timing or schedule doesn't work out. But yeah, I'm always pitching new stuff here and there, and I'm hoping in the next year or two to be able to develop some original stuff, but keep your eyes peeled for that.
Okay, very good. Looking forward to the Due Process one-shot. It should be an interesting and kind of cool exploration of Sarah's backstory from before she had the Witchblade. And I'm looking forward to seeing Alina's work on a full issue in continuity, because I've loved the cover work that she's done. And the image that's in previews here on page 206 is nice. I assume that's the cover. So
Being able to work with Alina was really fortuitous. Basically, like I mentioned, the whole opportunity came up due to an opening in the schedule. And literally, I pitched the story one day. I wrote the script overnight and found her online that night, emailed her. And it turned out she just happened to be available, just happened to have time in her schedule, and just happened to be able to deliver a cover in time for preview. So it all kind of came together in a week. So, yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for taking the time with me. And once again, for folks who find this interesting, I would urge you to go to your local comic shop and let them know that you want them to order copies of the Due Process one-shot. It'll be out in... it's the June previous, it'll be out in August.
It should be available in stores first week of August, yeah.
Yeah, so let your shop know, so they'll order it. That way it'll be there for you to buy. Thanks for taking the time with me, Phil.
Thank you very much, Bob. I'll see you around the block.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.